Future Commerce, the podcast about cutting-edge commerce. I'm Brian Lang. I'm here live at NRF with Brian Eisenberg.
How are you, Brian? It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, I'm super excited to be interviewing you. You're part of the IBM Futures team and influencers. Maybe you give us a little bit of information about yourself, where you're from, where you got your start, who you are, just the history.
How long do we have on the podcast?
Well, I mean, we've got as long as you want.
Well, so I've been in this industry since the mid-90s. Actually, I first started optimizing my first online experience in 1983 when I was hacking my bulletin board program to change where people would go inside the bulletin board. So I guess I've always been a little motivated at seeing how obviously these interfaces make people respond, right? Why people do the things they do. By 1998, my brother Jeffrey and I started the first agency focused in on conversion rate optimization called Future Now. During those years, and we haven't been in the agency now for almost 8 years, we published several books, Persuasive Online Copywriting, Call to Action, Waiting for Your Cat to Bark, and Always Be Testing. A couple of those were New York Times bestsellers.
Nice.
I was the founder of the Digital Analytics Association. And I mean, basically, I've been focused on trying to get companies to really understand that what digital has done is given companies an edge by giving us data tied to individuals so that we can understand them and create better experiences for them using the interfaces at our disposal.
That's unbelievable. Yeah, no, I think it was a hot topic when you started, and it's still a hot topic now.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, when we first started in 1988, everybody really was worried about, as an agency, was really focused about traffic, right?
I mean,
those are the days still of boo.com and stuff like that. You know, you had Pure Flash sites and stuff like that. I mean, it was a real mess.
Think about that.
Yeah, I mean, but back then, it was so easy to optimize websites. You know, back then, it was just as easy as putting a continue shopping button because they didn't exist.
Right.
Or making the button above the fold because they couldn't even find the button. And retailers were resistant back then. I mean, you know, obviously Jacob Nielsen was around and started talking a little bit about usability, and some of the companies that started following the importance of usability online definitely, you know, made it through that dot bomb crash, right? Several of our clients, I mean, we have a classic example of a small magazine retailer back in the day. He was one of our first paid clients.
Yeah.
He was part of an incubator here in New York City.
Nice.
Never forget that. And do you remember, was it eMags or something like that? They were like $18 million or something like that.
Yeah, vaguely remember that, yeah.
And they crashed and burned, and he went on to continue, you know, because we quadrupled his conversion rate.
Nice.
Right? So,
wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, you know, and it still surprises me today that, you know, as hot as it is and as many solutions are there out, you know, that are out there today, that companies aren't taking advantage of. And there's a number of reasons why that's still happening, though.
Yeah, no, that's actually... Why don't you tell us why? I mean, I'd be curious to hear your take on that, because I agree with you. I think that there are a lot of really quality solutions out there, but in my experience, it's been kind of difficult to get people to actually utilize what's available.
So when we first started, you know, my brother and I always thought that conversion rate was a measure of your customer satisfaction, right? And for you to succeed, your customers need to succeed first. That was our principle. In today's age of social media, I don't think anybody would argue with that principle. Back then, that was kind of novel. And we always felt that conversion rate optimization really needed to be a C-level problem. And today, it's delegated really to managers at best, maybe a couple of directors.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not viewed as a strategic thing. Customer experience is strategic. There was a Bain study found a few years ago. When they asked the executives of the corporation, did they feel that they were customer-centric? 80% of the executives felt they were customer-centric. Yet when they asked those same customers of those companies, and it was like 263 companies, only 8% of those customers felt that the organizations were customer-centric.
Wow.
So huge gap. You know, there's been studies on, you know, on the stock market showing how companies that invest in customer experience outperform like by 70%. The laggards in customer experience. And this is over a six-year period. And conversion rate optimization is just one piece, right? If you think about it, one piece.
It's very measurable piece.
Very measurable, very easy to test, very quick to see results because it's just on one channel in the digital and you can control the environment like a scientist.
Yeah.
And if you can really see, and I think this is where, you know, Amazon, who Jeff Bezos, in his letter to stockholders, talks about how last year they performed over 1,900 tests.
Wow.
On the Amazon product page, you can't test anything above the fold without Jeff Bezos' permission. Right? That's a CEO who cares, who understands the value. And there's a reason why they've dominated e-commerce.
Yeah.
They understand that this, you know, conversion rate optimization and this culture of innovation and tying that to being so customer-centric is the ultimate competitive advantage. And they've leveraged that to dominate e-commerce. And I think the real opportunity today is not to think about conversion rate optimization of your web channel, but now that we're seeing so much, like, I mean, I was walking the trade floor show of, and we saw a technology that let people put little chips like in the soles of people's sneakers today, and they can track if it's on the shelf and if people take it off. And if the person wears a sneaker to the stadium in the UK, it opens up the club for them. If not, it doesn't.
That is amazing.
So when you think you can now track to that level, which is the same we were able to track on digital, right, online, the opportunity to optimize the offline experience is really the holy grail, because that's where 90% of the dollars are.
Well, not only that, but I mean, the reality is we have not been able to do that. And it's just in recent years where certain technologies have enabled us to.
Yeah, you've got the RetailNext, and you've got some, you know, some of the cameras that are out there, UCLIDs, right? And Google's working on one with LiDAR. Yeah, that are trying to measure, you know, where people are standing.
No, of course.
But it's primitive. But when you can take it down to the product level.
Yeah.
Right? And it's moving off of shelves.
Yes.
It's moving from the background and the people hold it. It's like, now you can optimize that whole customer journey from when they start on their mobile device till they get to your store, till they pick up the product, till they try it, till they buy it, do they become a loyalist. And the opportunities are endless.
Have you talked with any customers, just going to go on a little bit of a bunny trail, about sort of the feeling that they're being monitored? I mean, we already know, when we're online, we know, right? But but the idea of having a chip in my shoe is a little bit unsettling. And I mean, I'm on a blog or a podcast that focused on the future of commerce, but it's still just a little bit. My co-host and I have talked a ton about you know, consumers and the choices that we make around what kind of data we give. And in this case, a lot of people may or may not even know that they've got a chip in their shoe.
So when the first telephone book was published with the first 50 names in it, people were freaking out that their numbers were listed.
Yeah.
This privacy debate has gone on going for 100 plus years, right? This is nothing new.
Yeah.
And the reality and what we know over time, it's, you know, it's been tested. People will forsake their privacy for convenience over time.
Yes.
And the biggest problem, and the biggest problem that beacons have had in terms of their adoption and their use, is that very few customers saw an added value to it.
Yep.
Right? And so what I love about this example that these folks from SmartTrack actually gave me is, you know, Nike has embedded this into one particular shoe, right?
Yeah.
And so only if you're wearing that shoe can you gain access to that club. Now, that's an exclusive.
That is exclusive.
Perk.
That's amazing.
And it's like, if you want access to that club, you don't care that you're being tracked because you actually want to be tracked. You want to get in there.
Totally.
And I think when you start figuring out how the tracking aids the customer, right? Gives them that personalized. I mean, look, we all know anytime we want to do anything on Amazon, right? You have to log in either with your phone number or log in with your email address. This is the competitive advantage they started off with. They knew that to be Earth's most customer-centric company didn't mean to be all warm and fuzzy, meant I knew everything about the customer.
Yes.
Right? I can use that data and build it, as opposed to Walmart, which was the largest retailer beforehand, that knew everything about products and stores and the logistics between it, but doesn't know anything about who walked in and who walked out.
Well, and the crazy thing is, you know, with Amazon, they have built that in such a way, and this is, I think, the key. I trust Amazon.
You trust them.
Yep. I trust, as a consumer, I know when I hand over my information to Amazon that if they betray my trust, there's going to be an outcry of epic proportions. And, you know, it...
Absolutely. And, and you know, I think another a great example of this, because you know what? They'll likely be hacked. Everybody gets hacked. Everybody loses data. But it's how you respond to it. And,
that
you know,
too.
What's really impressed me in the last year with Amazon, and you know, they're like a snowball, just, you know, it's growing and growing faster and faster, yeah, and bigger and bigger. Was, you know, there was this whole big uproar about the employees and how they were being treated, and Jeff Bezos took it straight on and said, you know, he went out and he talked to employees and yep. he said, this doesn't sound like the Amazon I know, but we're going to find out.
Yeah.
And they made a whole bunch of changes.
They did.
Because of it.
Actually, we talked about this on the show. Shortly thereafter, they started piloting a 30-hour work week
yeah.
in their HR department, which yeah. I thought was a great, like, hey, this is tangible change.
And so the same thing, right? They are, at some point, probably going to make a mistake with some customer data.
Yeah.
But they're going to react to it. We all are going to fail, yeah. right? But it's how we respond to it. It's how we own up to it that matters. Mm. And as long as they can say, hey, you know, we did this with the proper intentions.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's what his intent was in that statement of being Earth's most customer-centric company.
Yeah.
Right? That's what they meant. They're focused in on always being at the cutting edge and understanding the future customer, right, and not worrying about what's changing.
So
just
true.
Keeping up with customers, not their competitors, right?
And right,
you know, they're not packaging everything with chips today, but they will as people get
yeah,
ready.
Yeah, no, we talked about this quite a bit as well. Essentially, once utility outmatches concern,
that's right,
and it will,
and it's a seesaw, and it's yeah. a seesaw. That's yeah. exactly it.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of other things. There's a few other things that at the show where, you know, as a consumer, I can see why people might be a little bit hesitant.
Yep.
Like, for instance, and we talked about this back on episode 8, there's actually a company called Thursday's Finest or something like
right.
that that's doing body scanning. And then they're doing bespoke printing of clothes
right.
in, you know, in store. And they're like, yeah, we can't go after anyone over 30. No one over 30 is going to get their body scanned. People
right.
under 30, yeah,
they're totally comfortable.
They're ready. They're ready.
But it's also like, you know, so we're here at the New York Hilton, Midtown.
Yeah.
And this is actually the first time I'm using the Hilton app in a hotel that has a digital key.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's been great. I mean, I love not having to worry about carrying that extra key because, you know, you always leave it somewhere. It's not like your regular keys.
Yeah.
My phone, I'm always going to have on me. And I can imagine next evolution of the app, I actually have the built-in concierge. Right. They know my location.
Oh, for sure.
They know
absolutely.
Where I am. It's like
did you see
how amazing could it be? It's like, okay, you're getting to your floor. You know, we're having a cocktail hour. They can do so much with that, giving us context of the location.
Oh.
Because that is what a hotel is about. Right.
Absolutely.
And the same thing with retailers. As we give the permission
yes.
for the convenience, right, and you keep giving me benefits, keep tracking away.
That's another thing that I think is coming up here. I feel like, take this for what it is, but there was a little bit of a move away from the word, at least, efficiency. Like we kind of went to a period in the sort of mid-2000s or probably late 2000s yeah. where it was like, you know, people that are focused on efficiency are bean counters.
Yeah.
And I think that was, you know, that was, you know, a very silly trend. But in all reality, I think coming up here, I actually think we're going to have an entire set of commerce, strategic commerce based around personal efficiency. And so, like...
Well, and we see that, you know, like with what Under has been doing with all their data collection, right? And,
yeah.
And,
yeah.
And the personal health
yes.
tracking.
Yes.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we know so little about the body as an example, right?
Uh-huh.
We know so little about actually our workforce. Like, you know, I wear an Apple Watch and the number one reason I wear it is so it can nudge me every hour to get up.
Get up, right? Exactly.
And that's an efficiency to help improve my body, right? Because it's a terrible thing for sitting hours upon hours upon hours.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, I actually wanted to pull more data. I'm absolutely comfortable. And I also wanted to get to the point, right? Again, you know, and I'm in my mid-40s.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I'm probably pushing the limit. But it's like I have no problem with an insurance company leveraging that data and using it to give me a better premium than the average 46-year-old
exactly.
in my age group.
Absolutely. You know, it's crazy. I think eventually, you know, actually, I think body scanning and body monitoring will probably be covered by insurance.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. In which case, eventually, you know, instead of us having to go reach out to our healthcare systems and schedule appointments because we feel bad, the doctors are
they'll be able to detect.
And,
well, and that's what Watson Health is doing.
Watson Health, yes, that's great. Yeah,
it'll peer through all the data that's going on and says, okay, you know what? We're starting to see epidemic type things, the precursors of epidemic of flu.
Yeah,
your stress levels have been going up. Either find a way to relax, and get away from the germs, or you're going to end up with the flu.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
I want that info. Absolutely.
I want that info.
Yeah. Another good example of this is the IBM Watson collaboration with OnStar and General Motors, where they're including Watson in the dash.
Yep.
And they're providing, hey, you should stop here because it's actually going to be more efficient for you to pick this thing up on your route. Instead of waiting till later.
And that's assuming that we're going to be driving and not being driven by the car, right?
That's right. Yeah, so true. So true. Good point. Cool. Well, hey, I know you're about to release a book.
Yes.
I've already got a little bit of a sneak preview of it. It is fantastic. Very easy read, very conversational, very insightful. But maybe you could tell us just a little bit more about it. Without giving it away. Go ahead and give it a quick summary.
So, as you can already hear in the podcast, I've been fascinated with Amazon over the last number of years and what's made them work. What about their culture is duplicatable by other businesses? I think what they've done, especially with Prime, they've created such a loyal tribe of customers. And against all traditional branding efforts, one of the strongest brands in the world today.
Yeah.
And so we've written a book, and I believe it's for all types of businesses, both from service businesses, because obviously they do B2B and they do B2C, right? And they built strong brands in all of them.
Yep.
It'll work with your mom and pop store to the Walmarts of the world, right?
Right.
I mean, it'll work for anybody. The tentative title of the book is Even a Lemonade Stand. Can brand like Amazon.
I like that, yeah.
Right? So it's obviously for the entrepreneurial. And there's a couple of key things that I think we focus on that you have to have as your faith-based initiative, as my friend Avinash Kaushik would say. And actually, Jeff Bezos talks about it too. One of the elements of faith you have to have when you join Amazon is they don't worry about stock price, for example.
Right.
Why? Because they know over the long term that will take care of it.
Yep.
I think one of the things that have plagued retail in the last quarter century has been a lot of the retailers who are public companies, the ones who've been bought up by public equity firms. And there's been such a focus in on short-term deliverable results.
Yeah, quarterly results.
Quarterly results that it's been hard to keep up with all the change. We're living in the most disruptive period other than the Industrial Revolution, and that happened over a long cycle.
It's insane.
It's insane the amount of change. I think about, I have three kids, 15 to 7, and just what's changed within their lifetime.
Yes.
And so,
I've got a bugaboo. I want to interject it really quickly.
Okay,
we'll get there, yeah.
But it's like, you need to find a way, and I think Amazon, using what I call their four pillars, and we playbook, and we give you the four pillars in the story, and it's written in the form of a grandfather talking to his grandson along the journey.
Nice.
And they start off in a Starbucks, of course, because where else would you do it if you're on a road trip?
Of course, especially being from Seattle,
appreciate that, exactly. And we talk about how these companies can obviously brand like Amazon.
Yeah. Right.
So what's the bugaboo? I was just curious.
You mentioned how quickly the pace of change is happening and how the experience between even your oldest child to your youngest child is so drastically different. And I cannot stand the term millennial because I feel like the pace of change is actually creating much smaller generational gaps.
It's not only that. Let's remove the term together. My co-author for this new book is Roy Julian. His last book was called Pendulums. And he talked about how the world basically depending on your religious persuasion, has been going through these 40-year pendulum gaps, right? 20 years up, 20 years down for thousands of years, right? Even in the Bible, they talk about cycles of 40 years and 40 years.
Yeah.
And so I don't think they're changing. I think what's happening is that the leaders of the generation are adapting so quickly to the changes.
Interesting. Okay. Interesting. I like this.
Yeah. That the line is blurring, and they're bringing just everybody along with them.
Huh.
And what it really is just a tribe. It's a tribe who views the world in a particular way.
Yes.
And, you know, we were talking about it today with a bunch of the futurists as well. It's not that millennials are technological savvy.
Yeah.
They're technologically dependent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
They're attached to technology at their hip.
Yeah.
I mean, my daughter does, like, she doesn't want a TV screen in her room because she's just as comfortable watching Netflix and Amazon Prime videos on her phone.
On her phone. Absolutely.
You know, and it's like, I don't know. I mean, with my eyes today, I don't want to look at a tiny screen the whole time.
Just get a Note 7. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but that's the way she's been brought up. My little one has been on a tablet since basically he could move his fingers.
Yes.
I mean,
yes. You know. So, tablets, phones, voice. I mean, one of my children, some of their first words were Alexa. Like, that's.
And I think the lesson to learn for a lot of retailers, and this is what I love about folks like 1-800-Flowers, you know, they built these triggers into Alexa. CES, they've talked about 70,000 devices that created triggers for Alexa. And Amazon wasn't even there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's so amazing. It's like, you know, they're building on this platform, and they're still in early generations. You know, Google Home also has developed a great product, which is actually a little bit more contextually aware in terms of conversation.
That's right.
But you know what? Amazon iterates extremely quickly.
Yes, they do.
And they will be there because they're not going to let somebody be ahead of it.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, and they also have a huge jump start in terms of ecosystem.
Well, and they said they've improved the voice recognition by like 4x this past year alone.
It's mind blowing. I signed up for an Echo the first day they released.
Same thing.
And it's just continually gotten better.
But what I think that people miss in the retailing world is, you know, I believe, and I've been saying this for years, is, you know, there will be an Alexa in refrigerators in the next number of years. And it's not going to be an Amazon refrigerator, but if they're going to partner with the Samsung's G, they're going to be an ecosystem, just like OneClick, just like Amazon Web Services, just like they're talking about with Amazon Go and their checkout. These will all be part of their services that they'll be able to apply. So if you're a grocery store, right, you're going to be one tied into Alexa. So I can say, hey, you know what? I just ran out of milk. And the next thing I know is that at some point in the afternoon, you know, it'll detect by my mobile phone that I'm almost coming home and deliver it.
So actually, this gets back to something that I've been recently kind of thinking about quite a bit. And it's a term, I don't know if anyone's even using it. Probably are. I think of things and then I find out that other people are already thinking of them. But the idea of personal inventory.
Great minds.
have you thought about personal inventory? The idea of having, like, something that you might not even be fully aware of, but the idea that technology is sort of tracking what you have, the clothes in your closet, the stuff in your fridge or your pantry, and is going to be alerting or actually restocking you without you even having to think about it.
Yeah, and we see that, you know, customers are really becoming so accustomed to this, you know, with all the subscription, you know, fashion services that are out there.
Yeah.
You know, there's that one that will send you, I know it was on Shark Tank recently, like, you know, that sends you the underwear, the socks, sweatpants.
Oh, yeah.
You know, for like $60, it sends you 17 items to replenish your thing. And then, you know, you can do that every couple of months. And customers just come, that concept of replenishment and managing the inventory. And when the technology detects, hey, you know, your shoes are getting a little thin and not supporting you as well, just let me send me a new shoe.
Yeah, or they might start tracking aggregate data of how long it takes to wear down their soles. And then actually they'll be able to put, the lifespan of this shoe should be about 3 years. And then when 3 years come along, hey, we'll replace that for you.
Well, it's funny because I was in the innovation center on the NRF floor.
Yeah.
You know, there was a couple of technologies. One that let you take pictures of your shoe to kind of get the sizing.
Yes.
And of course, that didn't get the height right. Then there's the 3D scanning of your feet.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, why isn't Nike putting the chip in there? Because it can detect exactly how many miles I've done on those shoes. Because I mean, I track it on my phone.
Right.
Right. But I also switch switch running shoes every other day.
Yeah.
I was like, but why couldn't they tell me exactly where it's there?
On that particular shoe.
They can tell where the pressure is and if there's certain parts that are doing more. And then they can alert me, right, when it's time to change before I actually have an injury.
Exactly.
And would I be willing to pay more for that? Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah.
And would I be willing to pay a subscription service, right, to have it replenished on demand? Absolutely.
Absolutely. And would you be willing to give up that data? Absolutely. Yeah, I know. It really comes down to, you know, how much utility you're going to generate.
That's right.
So I wanted to get back to something. I know we're, I think we actually might be running out of time here shortly. Which is unfortunate. We didn't get close to, we might have to have another interview.
We might have to have another interview. That's
yeah,
fine.
Because I really want to talk to you about brands. You know, especially since your upcoming book is focused on brands, the future of brands fascinates me. Like, what, with all this tech and all everything's coming on, are brands going to look different now than they did, you know, over the past 10 years? How are people going to use them? What is a strong brand going to look like? What types of companies will need a strong brand, and what kind of companies won't need a strong brand? This,
I think we've actually answered this in some ways throughout this conversation.
Yes, they have. Yes, we have. Yes.
You know, strong brands are brands that people trust.
Mm-hmm.
Strong brands are brands that we feel comfortable sharing our data with.
Yes.
We allow them into our lives and into our homes, into our personal space.
Yeah.
Right? And we do that because they deliver value to us consistently and through their actions, not their words.
Beautiful.
Words are cheap. Actions are where it matters. And I think, you know, when we're talking about the future of commerce, right? I think the key thing about this is all of this is being driven by data. And more and more and more and faster data than we've ever dealt with before. And the companies are going to have the most competitive advantage. And this is something Jack Welch started. This is something that Jeff Bezos understood when he started Amazon, that digital was going to give him this advantage.
Yes.
Right? Is that the company that has the ability to take that data, take action on that data, right, and execute, has the ultimate competitive advantage. And we look at things like artificial intelligence and the algorithms that are going to be out there and how integrated all that data is throughout your whole channel, right? From supply chain to marketing to offline to content, everything. Now, and then to customer, obviously, now is when you're going to have the strongest brand. And you have to work at it every single day. And you're only as good as the weakest link in your company.
Mm.
And so everybody in your company has to be able to share the same story, have the same passion, and deliver it day in and day out, because you're only as good as that last experience.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think with that, we actually do need to wrap up. But I would love to interview again, because I wanted to dig into CRO and Watson. We didn't even get to Watson. I mean, that was half the reason we were going to talk. So let's continue this conversation soon.
Absolutely.
Hey, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Brian.